My name is Trina Teeler and I'm conducting this interview on behalf of the Wellcome Trust for Anthony Gormley's One Another project. The day today is the 7th of October 2009 and the time is nearly 20 past 8 p.m. Could you please give me your name, age and where you're from?
I'm Suzanne Piper, I'm 61. I was born in Dartford, Kent, but I now live in Spielplatz at Bricket Woods and Albans. And Spielplatz is a naturist community which has been in existence for about 70 years. And there are about 30 units of accommodation where people live all the year round, a similar number where people live just during the summer months, plus we have caravanning and camping. And we are quite a gated community, and it's a naturist community. And we still actually have the daughters and grandchildren of the founder living within us. Lots of facilities, clubhouse, swimming pool, and lots of activities, and lots of the people from Spielplatz are actually coming down today.
And what inspired you to live there?
Basically, I loved living down on the south coast. We were living at Lydd-on-Sea, right on the edge of a National Nature Reserve, and tremendous sense of space and that down on Romney Marsh. But my partner didn't actually like it. It was too quiet for him, and he wanted somewhere that was a bit busier, but also where we could still be naturist, because we had the seclusion down there, and all our neighbours knew anyway. So Spielplatz, there was a vacancy, there was a bungalow available, so we went and purchased it. But we do tend to stick within the community for most of our social activities.
And what inspired you to be a naturist?
Oh, well, I could have been a naturist when I was a baby, because my father was actually invited to join a local naturist club, and he turned it down. And as I grew up, I knew about naturist clubs because there was one near where I used to go riding, and there was another one out towards Brands Hatch, and when it was teenagers we tried to find it when we were out cycling that way. But it wasn't until that hot summer of 1976, which you're far too young to remember, and it was the summer we were promised this year, which never happened, but it went on, and it went right through to the end of August, and it's gorgeous. And I was actually working at the Chalfont Centre, and we had a holiday place down there, and I took some residents down on holiday with a couple of other staff. And after my stint, there was a caravan. So that I got out of the way of the other staff and the other people going down, I'd heard about this beach, and I'm very, very inquisitive. I like to know what makes people tick. And so I went along, I met some nice people, got my kit off, and I did get burnt, even though it was an overcast day. So you have to be very careful, even in British summer, at the seaside on an overcast day. And since then, I've been a naturist. And once you've actually got your kit off, you don't actually think about it. Within 5 minutes, it doesn't matter.
So where you live in Spielplatz, are you naked constantly, or how does it work?
You can be nude as much as you like within the community, but of course the weather is a major player. But we're fortunate in that our bungalow has actually got a log burner, and because the arborists come in quite regularly, we've got a good supply of logs. So we're actually quite carbon neutral. And so our bungalow's nice and warm, the swimming pool's warm, and, you know, okay, you can go for your swim, and then you get dressed quite quickly at the moment. But so yes, if you, any time that it's comfortable for you to be nude, and this is what naturism's about, it's being nude when you're comfortable being nude and in an appropriate setting. And so therefore, you know, as it is a community, it's very comfortable, and people are nude all the time. And some of the people have got more tolerance to cold than others. Because I've got ME, I tend to feel the cold rather. But other people will, you know, especially the men, they seem to be more hardy than us women.
So, and what did you say you have, ME?
Yes.
Okay, and since when?
I had to take early retirement because of it when I was 39. But I live in spite of it, not because of it, as it were. It doesn't get in the way. You work out what you want to do, you do it, even though you know you've got to pay a penalty afterwards. Because when I first had it, I listened to what the doctors were saying, you've got to rest. And I did have a very good GP that recognised it. And partially, I think, because we had a professional relationship, because he was the doctor for the residential home that I was matron of, or team manager. And because we were very much a team. And so when I was actually talking to him, he knew that I wasn't putting anything on, he knew me. And so therefore, the symptoms I chose to describe to him, because they didn't actually fit anything I knew as a nurse, he accepted and he supported me. And any referrals I want, I got. And so I was seen up at the Royal Homeopathic Hospital, and I got, you know, all the treatment that I was asking for through the National Health. But then in the end, I decided this isn't working. So I actually set my own pace and set my own goals. If I wanted to do something, even though I might be laid up for a while afterwards, then I would take it on, do it. Much as, you know, this year I've had some busy weeks, and then I've ended up being laid up for a few days afterwards. But, you know, but you enjoy doing those things. And if you don't do things, then you might as well turn up your toes and disappear.
And could you tell us a little bit more about the disease itself?
It started, I'd actually been working very, very long hours in residential care, looking after the elderly, mentally infirm, responsible for a 53-bedded home. And there was a lot of stress. I was also on my days off going off and doing Red Cross work, because I was in charge of first aid at Sandown Park. And didn't go off sick when I should have gone off sick with flu and various bugs, because if you went off sick, there weren't enough staff to cover. And basically my body in the end said, enough's enough. And that was it for 6 months. Even getting out of bed to go to the loo was a struggle. You'd sit in a chair and the television would be there. And it was on, but it was just a noise. You couldn't concentrate to read. And I love reading. I love sewing. I like doing creative work. But now I tend to sometimes overload myself again, because I do a little bit of work supporting a cat rescue down in Kent. And somebody from the rescue's up today, and she deserves an OBE.
What in Kent?
A cat rescue.
Oh, okay.
And at the moment there's 60 cats and kittens in care, and more to come in, plus her own. I've only got three, plus one that's moved in with one of the older ladies on site. She's in her late 70s and she loves cats, and she's rather pampers Daisy, so Daisy knows what she gets. She's got her paws under the table. But yes, I've got three other pussy cats. And the eldest is 17 and a half, and she's quite a character. She was born on the 29th of February 1992 and rescued out of a rubbish bin when she was less than 2 hours old with her sister. And we lost her sister when she was 9 through liver failure. But Louise is getting a few problems now, but she's still a right little madam. And then I've got Louis, who's my big, brave boy, and he's on a diet. So we're feeding Louise with kitten food to get her calories up. We're feeding Louis diet food to get his weight down, but he prefers the kitten food. And then we've got a little Italian cat who came with her passport that none of the rescues have got space for, so we just took her in. And her name's Silvietta. And she likes the oral stuff, but she had to have four teeth out when she came to us. So she's quite a sweetie. But so yes, cats, and I've got my partner David, who appeared in the second week of the project. He did the 8 till 9 time, and he's the techie side, and he's the one that does the web design and all of the, you know, program writing. I'm the one that does the creative side, and I produce the magazine Naturist Life. And whenever I ask him for help, he says, I don't understand that, but everyone thinks he knows more, you know. So we both have different things, and we complement each other with our work. So, and really doing the magazine has been quite a challenge, because I've taught myself how to do the layouts and everything. And I think it's coming along quite nicely. I've been quite pleased with the last two issues.
What are you going to be doing on the Vin?
Well, I'm going to go up in the nude. I've got a banner to put out which has got a phone number on it, which people will be able to ring me on. It's via Skype, and I'm setting it up so that people can hear online. And it's me being on the plinth is being set up for the people online, because at this time of the night and with the background noise and my very bad hearing, I'm unlikely to be able to hear people down below. But I've got a lot of friends that are coming along, and they will be able to talk to the people who come to along to say, well, what is this about? So they'll be there to talk to people about naturism in this country and abroad. And I'm hoping that some of our friends from all around the world will be able to ring in on Skype. And also on the ground, I know that we've got people coming up from the West Country and, you know, from quite long distances to come and support me tonight, which is great. But then I do know lots of people worldwide.
How do you feel naturism in this country compares to naturism on the continent?
Most people feel that it's not as free. But in fact, when you actually investigate, and which I have because I used to be president of British Naturism, used to mix with people from the other federations. So I do know about the problems, and I also represent some of the French camping sites. Now, France is, for example, which is what people love to quote, is 4 times the size of the UK, but with only the same population. There's a lot more space. And therefore, there are areas where there's space to set up really large holiday centres. And the value of the buff pound has been very much appreciated. And these are areas... for example, down the Atlantic coast of France, there are some very, very large centres. The largest actually is probably Euronet, which is 1 square kilometre, and with 35 kilometres of roads within its boundaries. And it's broken up into little villages. It's got 1.5 kilometres of beach of its own, but it's accessible. You can walk for miles along the Atlantic coast. And so the laws in France are actually very similar to our own, except that the mayors of the municipalities have much more power to bring in bylaws, or the equivalent of our bylaws, to prohibit nudity, and they will do so. Whereas in this country, those powers are now being taken, that particular power for dress codes on beaches has actually now been withdrawn from the local authorities, with the devolution of powers to local authorities. British Naturism and others have fought to ensure that dress codes were not included, and local authorities now no longer have the ability to bring in bylaws to prohibit nudity on the beaches. And so therefore, for example, at Courton, which is where there was a designated area, because of this revocation of the old bylaws, it means that people don't have to stick to that area anyway. They can go anywhere on the beaches up in Waveney District. So nudity per se in this country is not an offence. So therefore, I've cycled through central London in the nude with a police escort, because there was over 1,000 of us. But it's great going up all round here, and, you know, we came down the Haymarket, we came down past the bottom of here, down towards the Parliament, across Westminster Bridge. I've only done it once, but I've done it. And it was great fun, six miles. Took a long time because there's about 1,000 people. And that last bit down, coming down Park Lane, back to Admiralty Arch. And it is, apart from bringing the plight of cyclists, although I have to say that we have seen quite a few stupid cyclists today coming down. They're their own worst enemies in traffic. You know, no reflected jackets, no decent lights. You can't see them. But also, you know, there needs to be more dedicated cycle lanes and more facilities so people are encouraged to cycle. So yes, it was great fun. And yes, I have been nude in central London before. And my partner's done it 3 times. No, he I think he did London twice, but he's also done Brighton twice. So, you know, and the World Naked Bike Rides happen every year. And they're a massive event, and they happen in June in the Northern Hemisphere. So...
How was it growing up? Because you say you're 61, and what age were you when you started to get interested in
bicycling? Well, the thing is, I knew it was around. And that sort of thing, I think as children, you're fascinated by anything like that anyway. But as time went on, it was something that I was always aware of, but didn't do anything about. So it was when I actually heard about this beach, when I was working really hard. I'd had 2 really solid weeks down there. And I got talking to some really nice people. When I got back to Chalfont, I found out about the local club, went along. And in fact, Diogenes is one of, you know, 5 clubs that started up the Watford Swim. There's a lot of clubs in northwest London. And in Bricketwood itself, Bricketwood, Howard, there are 3 clubs still. There used to be 5. So naturism is actually quite big in this country. And we do actually have a lot more freedom than people think. But as I said, the situation, legal situation, is no better in France than it is here. But the perceptions, because people go to these lovely holiday centres and because they are commercial centres with lots of facilities, whereas in the UK, a lot of our clubs have been around for a very, very long time, and they've grown up on the self-help principle. A lot of them were formed before or after the war, but people didn't have a lot of money. This was getting out into the countryside, fresh air, exercise, meeting with friends, camping, and enjoying simple things. It's a bit like the hot pickers that went down to Kent from the East End. You know, that was their holiday. They were out in the fields, it was a change of scenery, they were earning a bit of cash, and the children went along, and it was a big family thing. But people didn't have money after the war, and so therefore the clubs were self-help. They were based on low membership fees, people mucking in together and building up a community. And perhaps we were the first environmentalists, because, you know, people were reusing stuff, and you always find the older clubhouses with sort of all sorts of donated furniture and things like that, which perhaps is not what young modern people want. But this is, it's something the values of that we had in the 60s in many respects that some of us still hanker for, that you could leave your door open and your neighbour would, you know, just pop round. You knew that people wouldn't be stealing from you. Whereas you can't do that very much in this day and age. I have to say, down in Romney Marsh, where I was living, it was good like that.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Why?
We had that sort of, just a little bit of road. It was very, very much that community spirit. But if you think about the, you know, the 60s, there was still communities, and a lot of the communities have been broken up. People say it's because of social migration. People can move around a lot more. But in fact, when I was doing family history, I was actually quite surprised at how much migration there was and how people did move around, especially agricultural workers, to actually find work, and the amount of emigration that took place. As I said, my family, I have now contacts with people in New Zealand, Australia and America from family who emigrated in the 1800s. And it's absolutely fantastic making these contacts and, you know, going around the churches for them and taking photographs of churches where family were married and things like that. So I'm making contacts all over the place. Super.
Are you still making contacts now?
I'm still making contacts. All of a sudden I'll get one link and that'll lead me to other links. And you go off it for a while. But, you know, it really now it's filling in, putting the flesh on the bones of a family tree, and it's finding out about the people that's the most fascinating bit. I got a letter from the 1840s, I think, a copy of a letter that was sent back to England from somebody that moved out to New Zealand and saying how good living was. And, you know, which somebody out there sent me. I've got photographs of my grandfather that I hadn't seen, that somebody else had got, because they were following the same line, him in his 1721st Lancers uniform, looking very smart with all his stuff on, and with his lances, which I hadn't got those photographs in my collection. And my great-grandfather, I've now got a picture of him
So how did they get hold of these photos?
Because they're same family and different people have hang on. Sometimes different members of the family will hang on to pictures and others have got rid of them. And they will have got rid of different pictures. So although I hung on to lots, I didn't get all of them. And so it's really exciting when you get a few new photographs. And, you know, and these are people you knew as well. And some of the photographs now help me to identify some of the photographs I've got, who the people are. Because I can't remember who it was I was a bridesmaid for example. But these pictures are now helping me to identify. I remember where it was. And it was down in Leemore, and, you know, I remember Billy the ram going through, it was Ram actually going through, with all his women going behind him, and, you know, but I was only about 11, I think, at the time, but maybe a little younger. But I couldn't remember which of the relatives it was, because my grandfather, I thought he was one of 10, he was actually one of 15. So this is it. You find out, and you're just adding little bits all the time. And so I've got a picture of him with quite a few of them, but not all of them.
Going back to your hour on the plinth, who would you say you're doing it for?
Me. I think that everyone really, if they're honest, they're actually doing it for them. Although, if you're doing it to make people aware of something, you know, you could say, well, I want to make people aware of something. But even that is still doing it for yourself, because you wouldn't be doing the project if it wasn't. You know, you've got to, you know, I've got to be satisfied with what I do to make it worthwhile for me. And if I can bring benefit and bring awareness to naturism, and especially to larger women, to say, I'm happy in my skin. And I'm fed up with all the people that are fattest and saying this and that. They don't know me. They shouldn't be prejudging me. Because unless somebody's my doctor and I've discussed it with them, it's none of their damn business. And perhaps I shouldn't be saying that on tape. But this is it. And the thing is that people push overweight people into depression, so they're more likely to be. But as I said, nobody knows why I'm overweight except for me and my doctor.
On that note, I'd love to go on, but
your time has run out. It could be another whole subject.
I know, and I want to ask you, but I can't anymore. Okay, thank you so much.